I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And coming up, is the private security contractor Blackwater USA a shadow U.S. Army in Iraq? But first, a new Pentagon report being released today concludes that 9 officers, including 4 generals, mishandled the investigation into the death of Pat Tillman. Tillman is the former pro football player turned elite Army Ranger who was killed in Afghanistan in 2004. The Army first said he was killed by enemy fire. Today's Pentagon report aimed to find out why it took the military so long to release the fact that the death was by friendly fire in a tragic misunderstanding on the Afghan border with Pakistan. Los Angeles Times reporter Julian Barnes has been following the story. He joins us from Washington. Julian, does this new report call that delay a cover-up?
We don't know how far it goes, but it does take these 4 generals and 9 officers altogether to task for failing to ask the right questions. We don't believe it uses that word cover-up, but it comes close.
Julian Barnes, remind us, what did happen that day? We know that Pat Tillman and his brother were in this elite unit, and a truck broke down, and that's where the story starts. The unit broke into 2. What happened then?
They were under pressure to make more progress, so the platoon commander split them in 2, and one half of the platoon continued going, and that was where Pat Tillman was. And they made a wrong turn, and so they were off of their planned route. And then they heard an explosion, and Pat Tillman, another soldier and an Afghan militiaman, thought the other part of their platoon was under attack. Well, that other part of the platoon saw these guys moving up the hill, and they thought that was the enemy, and they opened fire, essentially opening fire on Pat Tillman. He waved, said, no, you know, but the gunner couldn't hear them, and Pat Tillman was killed by the barrage of machine gun fire.
Earlier investigations by the Army found that officers told soldiers to keep quiet about the circumstances surrounding the death, and the military has acknowledged that soldiers destroyed evidence. They burned Tillman's body armor and uniform after the shooting. Are officers then accused of asking the wrong questions in the investigation into those incidents?
We believe the report finds there was enough evidence out there that the officers in charge of the Ranger unit should have known that they weren't getting the full story, and some of them may have known the full story and did not put that out there. Instead, they went forward and got a Silver Star for Pat Tillman and perpetuated a story that was inaccurate.
In fact, the Army for that apologized to Pat Tillman's family. His parents are being briefed on the new report today as well. His parents have said that they believe the Army fabricated this heroic version of Tillman's death to boost patriotism. Will the report speak to anything of that nature?
The Tillman family has really driven this. Their dissatisfaction with how the Army handled it was what has made sure that all this stuff is coming out.
We're reminded that right after 9/11, he gave up a multi-million dollar contract with the Arizona Cardinals to join the Army. His brother was in the same unit with him, and they were both assigned to this, you know, tracking high-value Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters on the Afghan border with Pakistan, so he was something of a star.
He was a huge star, even though he himself didn't want to do media interviews about his service. He was very important to the Army, and it was a huge news when he was killed, and the Army was frankly embarrassed that it was a friendly fire incident.
And what happens now, Julian, since this is one of several investigations now that assigns blame in this case for the reporting of his death? Are the parents going to sue? Is there any recourse, or do they just want to get the truth aired?
We think the family is much more interested in getting the truth out there and getting the Army to change its practices about how it notifies families, how it communicates about ongoing investigations. And the Army is making a point today and has been doing so over the weekend to say, we did make mistakes. We're already made some fixes. We're going to make some more fixes. They're doing a briefing right after the Inspector General's report this afternoon that will lay out more of what they're going to do in terms of better notification of families, following up on investigations, better probing what happens with each and every soldier's death.
Julian Barnes, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Again, the Army Criminal Investigations Command will be releasing a report today on the death of former football star Pat Tillman. Julian, thanks.
Thank you.
And this note, Pat Tillman's former college roommate, Jeremy Statt, also a former NFL player, wanted to join the Marines, but Pat Tillman talked him out of it. Then, inspired by Tillman's death, Jeremy Statt did join, and he was deployed to Iraq last week. When the conservative Weekly Standard gave directions to the world's largest private military base, the reporter wrote, "Head south from D.C., and when you hit North Carolina, follow the sound of gunfire. You'll find the headquarters of Blackwater USA. You can't miss it. It's over 7,000 acres, half the size of Manhattan." Blackwater first came to the attention of most Americans in March 2004 when four of its employees were killed in the Iraqi town of Fallujah. Two of the charred, dismembered bodies were strung up on a bridge, a memorable image. Blackwater has since become the most prominent private security contractor in Iraq. Journalist Jeremy Scahill says that raises a lot of questions, which members of Congress are attempting to answer. Jeremy is a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. He's written a new book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And he joins us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Welcome, Jeremy.
It's good to be with you.
Well, first of all, you paint a picture of a huge company. Let's continue to watercolor that. Blackwater, as we said, the world's largest private military base. How many employees does it have there, and what do they do?
Well, that's an interesting place to start because we don't know, actually, how many actual employees Blackwater has. What we do know is that Blackwater currently has 2,300 contractors, as they call them. I refer to them as mercenaries, deployed in 9 countries around the world. They have some 20,000 other contractors that are made up of special forces guys that are ready for deployment at a moment's notice.
Now, you say you use the word mercenary. Blackwater does not. They prefer private military contractor. And they say that it's mercenary isn't technically correct because they're not taking part in combat offensives. They only provide security or fight back if attacked. So tell us further why you think mercenary applies.
Well, that branding of these forces as private military contractors, private security contractors, is actually part of a very sophisticated rebranding campaign that Blackwater has been at the forefront of. I mean, the very essence of a mercenary is a soldier for fortune whose primary motive is monetary gain. The fact of the matter is that Blackwater says that it's not engaged in offensive operations, and yet it's at the vanguard of an offensive operation in Iraq, the occupation of a country. This is a company that has hired mercenaries from Chile, from Colombia, from around the world, and repackage them as part of this private fighting force in Iraq. Blackwater's own literature says that it's available to take part in small offensive operations. And what we've seen in Iraq is this company repeatedly be involved with firefights, whether it's in the defense of buildings, they would say, or their convoys coming under attack. The fact of the matter is that Blackwater is like the Praetorian Guard for the War on Terror and regularly is involved with combat in Iraq.
Well, in fact, we should say that it's been reported that at that training site in North Carolina, you can learn to rappel down a shipping container with a German Shepherd strapped to your chest. There are man-made lakes with ships. You can learn how to thwart terrorism. And let's remind us how this came about. You've made a lot of claims. Donald Rumsfeld gave a speech at the Pentagon on September 10th, 2001, a day, of course, before 9/11, sketching out what he called a revolution in military affairs, which was to privatize parts of the military. Then 9/11 comes, and ultimately, Rumsfeld did define contractors as part of the total U.S. military force. Tell us more about that and what implications that has.
Rumsfeld and his colleagues sort of envisioned running the Pentagon like a venture capital firm, or a private corporation. And a large part of that had to do with using high technology, smaller special forces, as well as contractors. And so one of the last things Rumsfeld did during his time as defense secretary was to issue a paper, the Quadrennial Review of the Pentagon, which outlined what he called a roadmap for change at the DOD. And for the first time ever, the Secretary of Defense defined contractors as constituting a key part of the nation's warfighting capability and capacity, the U.S. total force. Blackwater, in turn, has used that designation in several lawsuits that have been filed against it to argue that it can't be sued in civilian courts in the United States because it's a part of the U.S. total force and entitled to the same immunity from the civil litigation system that the military is entitled to. This was an extraordinary moment in the history of privatization and sort of bestowed on mercenaries a legitimacy that previously was almost unthinkable.
Well, in fact, initially, Blackwater was claiming that not only could it not be sued by civilians, but it also couldn't be court-martialed. It was claiming sort of this netherworld between any kind of questioning. And that was changed. Republican Lindsey Graham has adjusted that so that Blackwater employees can be tried as the military is.
Well, that's interesting. It's a fierce debate that's happening right now on Capitol Hill. Blackwater, beginning in 2004, was reported to be leading a lobbying effort inside the Pentagon and Congress to try to block its forces from being placed under the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, commonly referred to as the court-martial system. And Blackwater argued that its men are civilians and it would be unconstitutional to subject them to the UCMJ. Well, last year, Lindsey Graham, as you said, placed this language in the 2007 defense authorization that said that contractors would be subjected to the UCMJ. I think there's going to be some constitutional challenges to that. But then the flip side of that is Blackwater wants its forces to be subjected to domestic U.S. laws. And I believe that the reason Blackwater wants a prosecutor in Virginia to be investigating its operations in Iraq is because it's totally unrealistic. I mean, let's look at the serious reality on the ground. The Pentagon has 130,000 troops, and we know that there has been a shameful lack of oversight of the conduct of those troops, not to mention the 100,000-plus contractors that are running around. So the mercenaries are lobbying essentially for no effective laws to govern their Wild West presence in Iraq.
Well, that's being tested. Blackwater is now facing two wrongful death lawsuits, one from the families of the two employees that we mentioned were killed in the Fallujah attack in 2004, the other from the crash of a Blackwater helicopter in Afghanistan that same year. What are the families saying?
The families of the four men killed at Fallujah, I think it's important to note, I've gotten to know these families very well. All of them believed that they were patriotic Americans and that their loved ones were extending their military service. All of them thought that their loved ones were going over there to guard Paul Bremer because that's what Blackwater was known to be doing in Iraq at the time. And when they arrived on the scene, they find out that they're going to be guarding literally empty flatbed trucks going to pick up kitchen equipment. And when their loved ones were killed in Fallujah, they did, I think, what any parent or wife would do. They started asking questions. How did they end up in Fallujah that day? Why weren't they in fully armored vehicles? Why were there only two men in each of the vehicles instead of three, which the contract governing that mission provided for? And as they asked these questions, I think all of them had faith in Blackwater as a company at the beginning, and they say that they were stonewalled at every turn to the point where one of the mothers of a contractor killed, Donna Zavko, says that she asked Blackwater executives for his things, and she said that she wanted to see the incident report on the ambush that day, and she claims that a Blackwater representative said, that's classified and you'll have to sue us. And so sue they did. In January of 2005, they filed a groundbreaking wrongful death lawsuit against Blackwater, and at every turn, Blackwater has been shot down as it's tried to have this case thrown out of court, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's interesting, Blackwater's counsel of record is none other than Kenneth Starr, the man who led the impeachment push against President Clinton. Their previous lawyer was Fred Fielding, currently President Bush's White House counsel.
And that's Jeremy Scahill, frequent contributor to The Nation magazine. He's written a new book on Blackwater USA. It's called Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. It's the story of the company that was created in the mid-90s by former elite soldiers to capitalize on what they saw as a move in the government to outsource more military. We called Blackwater for a comment on Scahill's books and his claims. They said they had none. We'll have more with Jeremy Scahill after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Jeremy Scahill, frequent contributor to The Nation magazine and author of the new book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy, you call the military contracting company Blackwater USA the president's Praetorian Guard after the private force of bodyguards who protected Roman emperors, but call them mercenaries, as you do, call them contractors, as they do. There have always been mercenaries in wartime, and in the first Gulf War, there were private contractors, so playing devil's advocate, why the overriding concern now, especially if, as they say, this company can offset the lack of soldiers fighting in Iraq?
Right. I mean, I think that misses what I think is a very disturbing point. We have almost twice the number of forces that the U.S. will admit to having in Iraq on the ground because there's an army of 100,000 contractors. They operate in a legal gray zone at best. Their deaths don't get counted in the official death toll. Their injuries don't get counted. There are some 780 contractors that we know for certain have been killed in Iraq, 7,600 wounded. I believe the numbers are actually much higher. And so when you have half half of your occupation force that's not being counted, that there's no transparency over their operations. That is a shadow war that's being waged. And I think that to simply say, well, Blackwater has these highly trained guys that can keep a draft off the table and can do a job more effectively than, you know, a 19 or 20-year-old kid from Pennsylvania, is to not recognize that the real debate we need to be having in this country is, why is the U.S. engaged in offensive wars of conquest that mercenaries make a reality? If the Bush administration had to rely on the active duty army, we wouldn't see these kinds of adventurous foreign policies being implemented. It just wouldn't happen.
We note the ratio of private contractors to U.S. military in the first Gulf War was 1 to 60. Now it's close to 1 to 1. And as you said, it would seem to raise a lot of questions about, it's a shadow military. We don't really know what the costs of the war are, what the numbers needed to fight a war are, if half, fully almost half, is unaccounted for.
Right, and let's break that down a little bit. Of those 100,000 contractors, which I think is a suspiciously round number, I actually think that the number is much higher because the oversight is just non-existent. I mean, the Pentagon has repeatedly said it can't even count the number of contractors in Iraq, so that's just a rough estimate. And so I think it's very disturbing on a number of levels, and the fact is that Congress has been unable to shine any effective light on the operations of these companies, and it should be very disturbing to people who take seriously the idea of accountability in government.
Blackwater founder Eric Prince says that he can do what the military does cheaper. And he also says he can do for the national security apparatus what FedEx did for the Postal Service. He can do it better, faster, smarter. He says he believes in bringing an entrepreneurial spirit to the military. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, let's talk about who Eric Prince is. I mean, this is a guy who has been a significant bankroller of President Bush and Republican campaigns. He comes from a very well-known conservative Christian family in Michigan, the Prince family. His sister is married to Dick DeVos, the heir to the Amway fortune.
Being rich is not a crime, but your further point.
Well, it's not being rich. It's what he's done with his money. He has supported the rise of what we now know as the Christian right in this country. He has also supported the multiple Republican revolutions. And, you know, most successful companies they put butter on both sides of the bread. Eric Prince and his colleagues at Blackwater have never given a penny to a Democratic candidate. In fact, they've given money to the Green Party to defeat Democrats. So this is a company that truly has emerged as a Republican guard. And I think that's the disturbing thing about Blackwater, is how partisan it actually is. And it's ironic because Blackwater guards Nancy Pelosi when she goes to Iraq, as well as 90 other congressional delegations.
Well, your broader point is that they may even encourage the U.S. to go to more wars because of their lobbying effort for their business, which is the business of war.
Well, that's the concern that Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio has raised. He's concerned about the revolving door that apparently exists between the war industry and the politicians that seem most zealous to carry out these kinds of wars. And certainly, Blackwater executives have not only given money, but some of them have served in very senior positions in the Bush administration, and they're now taking with them all of their experience and knowledge to the company.
Is there also a concern that since these are civilians, they are not, trained soldiers, they can just get up and leave and go do something else if they don't like it? They're not part of a unit.
Right. I mean, and the fact of the matter is they don't work under the same rules of engagement that the active duty military soldiers do, and they're not subjected to the same kinds of disciplinary systems. And so it's encouraging this system that lacks an accountability. You know, when Blackwater says that its forces are cheaper, they don't take into account that the U.S. taxpayers spend millions and millions of dollars training the forces that Blackwater hires up and then repackages to the taxpayers again as more efficient, cheaper forces. The reality is that it's a bilking of the U.S. taxpayer.
Yeah. Military critic retired Colonel T.X. Hammes says he's seen Blackwater employees in action. They're aggressive. They do offend locals sometimes. They make enemies each time they go out. But he also praised their professionalism. He said they do what they're supposed to do, which is provide security.
Right. And what they also do is they inflame tensions and they create yet another heavily armed private force in Iraq. The absolute last thing that's needed in that country right now is more unaccountable privatized forces running around, whether it be an Iraqi militia or it be Blackwater. We need less guns in Iraq, less private actors in Iraq.
You know, Jeremy, you're obviously very concerned. But are you so concerned that you would worry that, you know, this is a shadow military paid for by Americans through contracts, huge contracts with the U.S.? But again, it's a shadow group. Who's to say it won't someday turn on Americans or on the government?
I mean, I'm glad you asked that, because Blackwater increasingly has its sights set on deployments inside the United States. Its men deployed several hundred strong in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Blackwater made $240,000 a day, billing the government $950 a day per man for the Katrina deployment. They're opening a new private military facility in Illinois, another one in California. They've applied for operating licenses in all of the coastal U.S. states. They're trying to latch on also to the Homeland Security Department's budget. They're marketing surveillance blimps to be used to monitor the U.S.-Mexico border. I think this is a very disturbing trend. And in many ways, I think in the coming years, we're going to be seeing the war coming home in many ways. One of them is an increased presence of these privatized forces operating at the state level, local level, and federal level.
Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And again, we called Blackwater USA, but they said they had no comment on Jeremy's book. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, quick look ahead. What happens to kids when their illegal immigrant parents are rounded up and taken away? And there have been mixed reviews for Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia, but we'll hear from our critic who sat through all 9 hours of the triptych. That's the ticket of the season in New York. That's tomorrow. Still to head in Texas, they call the wind a gold rush. After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When TXU, the largest electric utility company in Texas, reached a sale agreement with two investing groups, environmental groups cheered because they'd forced TXU to shelve plans for 8 new coal-fired power plants as part of that $32 billion deal. But now that those coal plants are out of the picture, how is Texas going to fill the energy gap? Jeff Bell's been writing about the Texas energy scene for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
So where is Texas looking to meet its growing energy demands? It's not going to just replace the energy that the TXU plants were supposed to add to the grid, but also we understand the state's just exploding. There'll be 30 million people living there over the next decade. So what kind of energy resources are jockeying for position?
Texas gets quite a lot of its energy from natural gas, gets quite a lot of its energy from coal, and then gets a very small amount of its energy from renewables, and that sort of small slice of the pie is growing.
But even though it's small, Texas is a national leader in producing wind power. Paint us a picture. What is it about the landscape and the state that's making this enticing for people?
Well, it's both geography and politics or economics. The geography is that Texas is a very, very flat place. Picture West Texas as a kind of a pancake flat topography with mesquite trees and sagebrush and essentially a tabletop where wind blows northward from essentially from Mexico up unimpeded and blows up into the Texas panhandle. And by the time it gets there, it's blowing very fast. There's a lot of it blowing, and it's a sort of wonderful place to stick some wind turbines and catch it.
In particular, Briscoe County, where Shell wants to build a huge 120-square-acre-mile wind farm, has this kind of topography you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, and stop for a minute and think about what 120 square miles is. It's massive. But there are vast, vast swaths of the western part of Texas, which are essentially nothing but ranchland and very, very windy ranchland. And so what you have here is not just Shell, but a number of other very large corporations who are engaged in essentially a land rush to lock up swaths of acreage in what most people consider to be the oil and gas patch for not oil and gas, but for renewable energy.
Well, in fact, the Shell farm that they're talking about, the wind farm, it would be 5 times the size of Manhattan. I'm trying to wrap my brain around that.
Right.
But it would only make as much power as one coal-fired plant.
Right.
So start with what are the possible downfalls of wind?
Well, I think that encapsulates it. It takes a lot of land to produce a measurable amount of electricity, and even what's measurable in the context of wind is very small in the context of traditional energy. Now, what you need, therefore, to do is, if you're going to produce real amounts of wind, you need to have a lot of land. And then, secondly, the problem is that a lot of the windiest parts of this country are far from the population centers. In the case of Texas, Briscoe County is hundreds of miles from, let's say, Dallas. Even if you could put up a bunch of wind turbines and capture all that wind, how do you get it to the people who are going to use it? Because Briscoe County residents aren't going to use that much electricity. So what's happening now is just as there's a kind of a land rush in places like Briscoe County, there's quite an intense lobbying battle going on in Austin, the state capital of Texas, by companies like Shell, which want new transmission lines to be built out to windy places like Briscoe County. And they're, all these companies are not going to get the lines to the places that they want. But it's a really high-stakes battle, and it goes to the point of the sense on the part of a lot of companies that renewable energy really is a potentially profitable venture.
Right, and not just potentially profitable with, at least initially, the help of state regulators, but even though it might have a smaller return, in other words, produce less energy than a coal-fired plant, it has less risk.
That's right. We should all remember profitable given state and federal subsidies. But nevertheless, those subsidies exist, and there's an expectation on the part of a lot of companies that those subsidies are going to expand. So from the point of view of a company, that's still profit.
Right. You call this a land rush, these companies running in to buy up this ranch land. And you talk about a farmer you met there in Briscoe County, Texas, Polk Arnold. Boy, some of these ranchers seem to be sitting pretty.
Yeah, it's quite a switch. I mean, Polk Arnold and his neighbors will tell you that until about a year ago, their land was worth essentially nothing.
Because of the wind.
Exactly. And these guys used to really curse the wind. And now all of a sudden they have these guys from deep-pocketed companies coming in, dangling relatively juicy land leases in front of them. These are the sorts of land leases that heretofore had been talked about only for oil and gas. And it's absolutely the talk of the place. And if you talk to ranchers about whether they want wind turbines sticking up a couple hundred feet out of the ground where they're now running cattle or producing cotton, they'll kind of look at you like you're strange and tell you of course they do, because the sound of those wind turbines turning sounds like money in their wallet.
But realistically, we understand that the need is both long-term and short-term. Will wind power be able to develop fast enough to make it fill that gap in the short term?
Oh, I think the reality is that wind power will not be able to solve anywhere near all of the electricity needs of Texas or of the United States or of the world. People who look at this kind of in a broad context will tell you that what's needed here is a broad portfolio of things. Wind is just one kind of renewable, and even if you add various kinds of renewables, the people who study this in a macro sense say that renewables will not solve anywhere near all the gap. You'll need all sorts of things, but I think one point is that even a relatively small slice of the broad energy pie is changing in its economics and is seen as increasingly economic and profitable.
Are energy analysts looking directly at Texas, using it as a test case of how to build an energy infrastructure that's diversified and doesn't rely on coal plants now that Texas has had these 8 plants knocked out from their plan?
Well, it's quite a switch, isn't it? I mean, Texas is widely viewed as sort of fossil fuel central. I think, yes, Texas is as good of a kind of a harbinger and barometer as any other place about how the world solves its energy crunch. But again, this is a slow process, and I think it's fair to say that fossil fuels are going to continue to provide the vast majority of electricity for Texas and for most places for a long, long time to come.
Jeffrey Bell, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. For more on wind power in Texas and elsewhere, go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, I do have to ask you, though, one of the concerns about wind turbines, especially here, perhaps off the coast of Boston where they're proposed,
right,
is that the sound of them is perhaps dangerous for, in this case, underwater animals. Is there any concern about, what are the environmental thoughts, if any, that have been raised in Texas?
Well, that's a good point. There are always environmental concerns, and the big one typically is birds getting ground up in these turbines that are spinning. One reason that wind developers like Texas so much more than they like Cape Cod, say, is that the spaces are bigger, that you're doing it onshore rather than offshore, which means that it's less expensive. And they say that the environmental concerns in terms of birds tend to be less severe in that kind of an environment than in a place like Cape Cod. And the other thing is that the public is just much more interested in having these things, because Briscoe County is one of the poorest counties in Texas. People there are really looking for some sort of jolt of economic investment, which may not be so much the case on Cape Cod. So these people are really excited about welcoming in these turbines.
Jeff, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
And we stay with energy, but move from wind to the next generation of cars. President Bush met with 3 auto executives today to talk alternative fuel vehicles. The executives were scheduled to highlight their cars of the future. GM brought along a Chevy Impala. It runs on E85, a fuel blend of 15% gasoline, 85% ethanol. Ford showed off its Edge High series. It features a plug-in fuel cell. Daimler Chrysler featured its Jeep Grand Cherokee, which is run on a biodiesel blend line called B5, and Toyota, maker of the popular gas-electric hybrid Prius, was notably not invited to the White House event. Still to come, jazz aficionado James Isaac is smitten with the voice of Tierney Sutton. You will be too. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, David Letterman is expected to say something on his show tonight about the loss of one of his program's most interesting characters.
Good evening. Certain NBC executives feel it would be a little unkind to present this show without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold a show featuring David Letterman.
That's Larry Bud Melman on the very first Late Night with David Letterman. For 20 years, Bud Melman was the straight man in the strange world of David Letterman, handing out towels at the Port Authority bus terminal, doing commercials for Toast on a Stick, wandering the halls in a bear suit looking for change, just a regular guy who happened to fall into an incredible gig. He was born Calvert DeForest and died last week at the age of 85 after a long illness. Joining us, the person who gave him the name Bud, former Letterman head writer Meryl Marco. Meryl, how did this happen? You and Dave were apparently watching a student film?
Right in the beginning, in pre-production of the show, when we were looking to hire writers, two of the writers that we eventually did hire had a student film in which they used Calvert, and he had right off the bat the strangest delivery that we had seen in a long time, so we thought, wow, if he's consistent with that delivery, that would be a great addition to the show.
Which was what? Explain the delivery.
You know the way that kids read a grade school speech about George Washington where it seems like they are disconnected totally from the content?
Yes.
It was sort of perfunctory, and it was correct, but it was without affect, sort of.
Right. Let's listen to a little more. This is when he was sent to the Port Authority bus terminal to hand out hot towels to people getting off the bus. Let's listen.
Do you have any questions? Oh, that's wonderful. Did you have a snack? Well, won't you please have a hot
towel? Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't know which is more fun, listening to Calvert or David breaking up, but...
Well, I was actually there at the Port Authority bus terminal, so I can tell you that was not the most fun place to be.
Well, so what was happening? Was that scripted, or were you
feeding... Yeah, everything that you did with Calvert was scripted. He was not a guy who ad-libbed. If he ad-libbed, it would be a guileless, without content sort of a moment. So everything that he ever did was on cue cards. We liked to listen to him read because he had that kind of disconnected, formal... sort of reading style.
So when he was asking people if they had snacks on the bus or whatever?
Yeah, those were on cue cards. And sometimes that was what would happen there, is we'd have cues for him on a cue card, but he wouldn't necessarily deliver it at a time when anyone had a snack. You know, he wouldn't make that additional leap of judgment of, you know, it says, yeah, do you have a snack? So I'll ask that if I see someone with food.
Can you just tick off some of the other, as they come to mind, tick off some of the other situations you'd put Calvert Bud in?
Early on in the show, we used to do these things called etiquette pieces. One was called subway etiquette. One was called laundromat etiquette. We used to always have him showing up kind of in a recurring nemesis fashion. Kind of, I guess my thought was at the time it was sort of like those guys who kept reappearing in Jack Benny sketches.
Yeah.
That banker who would go, well, kind of like that.
Yes.
But he was just perfect for demonstrating things because he would always bring the sameness to it of him. So whatever you put around him stood out,
right,
because he was always consistent.
I'm just, you know, wondering, as he's passed, it strikes us that he was one of the first. He was one of the original reality stars.
Yes and no. I mean, you really didn't get to know him in the sense that you get to know reality stars. We'd never been to his house. We don't really know anything about him. I mean, I spent sort of a long 4-day weekend with him once in the Virgin Islands because we shot there, not because I went away for a weekend with Calvert. And I really can't remember anything personal that he told me about himself. I don't know whether I wasn't asking because I thought I'd better off not knowing or what, but I mean, I really don't know anything about him.
So is the story of Calvert DeForest the story of a sad life, or is it a fabulous thing that happened to this guy who lived in Brooklyn?
Oh, it was an utterly fabulous thing that happened to the guy, and he was quoted as saying it was the best thing that ever happened to him. So he was a very happy, willing employee who really enjoyed what he was doing and would do anything you asked of him. He, without complaint, you know, he was a very sweet guy. As far as what the rest of his life was like outside of the time we spent with him in the studio, I couldn't tell you what it was.
It'll remain a mystery.
Well, we have been remembering the late, great Calvert DeForest, also known as Larry Bud Melman, with former Late Night with David Letterman head writer Meryl Marco, also, by the way, the author of several books, including her most recent Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. Meryl, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. James Isaacs, Here and Now's jazz aficionado, is with us, and he says that although 2007 is still young, the Tierney Sutton Band's new disc, On the Other Side, will definitely be one of the albums of the year.
Forget your troubles. Come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah.
Well, I'll bite. James, welcome. She sounds wonderful.
Hi, Robin. Yes, she really does have an incredible voice. It's the kind of voice that I think one would hear in the most beautiful dream one ever had, assuming, of course, that one has musical dreams, which I do from time to time.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. So tell us about her. Tierney Sutton, who is she?
She's 44 years old, originally from Milwaukee, currently lives in the Los Angeles area. She studied in Boston at the Berklee College of Music, and in fact, Tierney Sutton now teaches at the University of Southern California when she's not on the road with the Tierney Sutton Band. Incredibly, Sutton didn't start listening to jazz until she was 19 years old, so I guess she was a fast learner.
And she's not necessarily brand new. This is not her first CD.
No, this is her seventh CD and sixth for the Telarc Jazz label. All of her Telarc albums are first rate, but this new one is absolutely extraordinary. I think one could call it a concept album.
And what would be the concept?
Well, remember the album is called On the Other Side. In this case, she's referring specifically to the other side of happiness. Real happiness, hoped-for happiness, or the stuff of illusion. Now, the notion of happiness, as we know, especially the kind of idyllic happiness via lasting love, well, that's been a prime subject of countless pop tunes since the dawn of popular music. Mm-hmm. On this new album, 6 of the 13 songs contain the word happy in their title, including a couple of versions of Get Happy, mm-hmm. a slow one, and then elsewhere, a brisk shuffle tempo version.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. Got to chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining. Come on, get happy. Lord will take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Go to the promised land. We're heading across the river. Wash your sins away in the tide. It's all so peaceful. Oh.
There's also I Want to Be Happy, Happy Days Are Here Again, Make Someone Happy, and Glad to Be Unhappy. As Tierney Sutton writes in her brief but I think very clear-eyed liner notes, in the United States, our founding fathers guaranteed us, among other things, the pursuit of happiness. I always found it amusing that we weren't guaranteed the thing itself, but rather the right to chase after it. Mystics tell us it's the chase that causes our problems. We chase happiness, but often find the disillusionment and heartache of happiness lost or happiness missed. This music is about that search, the longing, the mania, the heartache, and perhaps even the joy of finding something better than the illusion we were chasing. Those words from Tierney Sutton.
So we have a theme.
Let's hear the Tierney Sutton Band's swinging take on the Depression-era favorite, Happy Days Are Here Again.
All together, shout no, there's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again, your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on.
James, you're smitten.
Yes, I am.
Where would you put her on your list of favorite female jazz vocalists?
Well, among the current favorites, she's right up there with Cassandra Wilson and Carol Sloan. I love Tierney's sound.
Okay. You brought in some other music for us to hear. What's next?
Robin, I want to recommend 2 new discs. The first is by the bassist-composer Scott Colley, and the second is by the drummer-composer Matt Wilson. More often than not, you know, we think of bass players and drummers as supporting players. We tend to think of trumpeters, saxophonists, guitarists, pianists as leaders of the various groups. But down through the years in jazz, there have been some very important bassists and drummers who've been band leaders. Think Charles Mingus, Ray Brown, Dave Holland among the bassists.
And Charlie Hayden.
Charlie Hayden, mm-hmm. Very good example as well. Art Blakey, Max Roach, and Elvin Jones for the drummers. Scott Colley has been, I'm going to say, for the last 15 years or so, maybe more, among the finest jazz bassists in New York. And here he is now. The album is called Architect of the Silent Moment, great title. It's on the Cam Jazz label. And the album shows us that Colley is a composer of consistently challenging music. Now, I'll admit this is not music for the novice or the more casual jazz fan, but the way in which Colley's originals shift the rhythmic focus and imaginatively use dissonance and varying levels of dynamics, occasionally moving into areas of disciplined free improvisation, well, this is most compelling all the way around. The piece we're listening to is called Strip Mall Ballet. Features an unusual pairing on the front line of trumpet and harmonica. The trumpeter is Ralph Alessi, and the harmonica soloist is Grégoire Marais from the Pat Metheny Group. Also, I want to note the contribution of drummer Antonio Sanchez, also from the Pat Metheny Group. Here's Scott Colley and his group, Strip Mall Ballet.
That's bassist composer Scott Colley, his new CD again, Architect of the Silent Moment. I do like that title.
Yeah, very cool.
And
title.
By the way, we have all of James' picks at our website, here-now.org. And finally, an album led by a drummer.
Matt Wilson, drummer and composer. And like Scott Colley, Wilson is in his early 40s. He's among the most in-demand jazz musicians in New York, again like Colley. Wilson's group is called Matt Wilson's Arts and Crafts. And their new album on the Palmetto label is titled The Scenic Route. I think of Matt Wilson as a highly inventive colorist on drums. By that I mean that he derives a wealth of sounds from his drums and cymbals, and he knows how to break up the time while never losing the flow, kind of like the great Paul Modian, although Wilson's sound is a bit crisper. The Wilson piece I've got for you is called In Touch with Dewey, and it was written for the late saxophonist Dewey Redman, with whom Matt Wilson worked on a regular basis. Redman died last September, and Wilson's band recorded this tribute just a few days later. The stop-and-start theme recalls Ornette Coleman's music, and of course, Dewey Redman worked extensively with Coleman in the late 60s and early 1970s.
Drummer-composer Matt Wilson's Arts and Crafts, again, a tribute to Dewey Redman. Oh, I hope there are more, by the way, tributes to Dewey Redman. It'd be nice to hear what musicians play in honor of him. But here's one, In Touch with Dewey. And James Isaacs, as always, it's good to be in touch with you.
Right back at you, Robin. See you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Public Radio International.